Hey everybody, welcome to the Snapcast. I'm Bobby.
I'm Alex.
I'm Jerry.
So this week it's just the three of us, no Chris. We have some work conflicts, trying to get schedules worked out, you know how it goes. But this week we're going to be talking about the reserve list, something that we've kind of touched on a lot in the past and something that's a pretty big hot topic, so we definitely want to get into it. That's going to be after the break, but first let's hop into this with some news, like always. So, I mean, first, let's check in on the Eldrazi, everybody's favorite new neighbors. They don't seem to go anywhere.
Surprise, surprise, they're in Legacy.
Yep. Yeah, so just in the recent week, we saw in the top eight of Legacy Open Philly, two colorless Eldrazi decks in the top eight. Looking at the numbers overall, we got seven in the top 32. And then in the Modern Classic that same weekend, we had two in the top eight as well. Which, that's actually, I mean, that's not too bad. That's toning it down a little bit from what we've seen. I mean, that might be a good sign for the meta that people are finding a decent way to, you know, combat this deck.
Well, but, I mean, that's like the Sunday event at a Legacy Open. Like, people aren't going to go there to play Modern. So, it's not really too representative. GP Detroit is still going to be the big representative of what the meta looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I would definitely say take it with a grain of salt, but two out of top eight, even in such a small event, that's still, you know, somewhat promising. And then in the top 16 of that event, we had five decks in the top 16, which that opens it up a little bit more. But from what we've been seeing, I mean, that really is considerably better. So that's definitely good overall. Well, Alex said, the coming up GP is going to be the biggest tell, and we'll see what happens there. But they did have Aaron Forsythe sent out a tweet just letting everybody know that there wasn't going to be an emergency banning. I mean, I think at this point in time, we kind of already knew that, right? I think we would have expected to see it by now if that was
going to be the case. The creep of terrible decisions from Aaron Forsythe continues.
But, I mean, they'll be addressing it on the normal.
Yeah, I'm just glad that they said that they're going to address it at the normal time.
Yeah.
Like, to kind of, you know, put to bed some of these people that are just, you know, now. Like, let it go, man. Let them do their thing.
Yeah, some transparency is nice. And, I mean, this is kind of the thing that I like to see, though, overall, is just that Aaron Forsythe sends out this tweet saying no emergency bannings. But we are addressing the fact, at least to some degree, that this is a pretty dominant deck and that this is a problem. So I think that's a good tip to anybody who is investing in these cards. Like, hey, maybe not, you know, don't go all in on these. These probably will be banned, even though they're not getting the emergency ban. I mean, yeah, you know, some transparency from Wizards is always nice. And I mean, I am interested to see what the meta does. At the end of the day, we always want to see the meta get shaken up at least a little bit. This was a little too extreme, but it's happened already. The bad juju's already there, so we might as well let it play out and see what comes of it, right?
Yeah, and when it's all said and done and a banning does happen, we'll look back at this time and be like, wow, that was one hell of a meta.
Yeah. So, I mean, it will be an interesting one for the record books there for Modern and even for Legacy, even though, I don't know, they probably won't touch it in Legacy, I would imagine.
I think it's absolutely fine in Legacy. It's funny how I haven't touched a single Legacy event, and in comparison to the first place deck list, I was only four cards off.
Nice.
Like, that's how close it was. Like, the big cards in the list were obviously your Chalices and your Trinispheres.
Right.
But the question is, do you want to play Thorn Amethyst with your Trinispheres or not? And you also had access to Jit, which is a card I wasn't playing. I wasn't playing any Jits, and I realized, huh, wow, hey, look, it's a Jace the Mind Sculptor for colorless.
Yeah,
how'd I miss this?
And I also appreciate them a little bit doing on the normal schedule, too, because maybe it shows they're taking a little more time on this. It's not just going to knee-jerk ban I, which is obviously the problem, and everybody agrees. Maybe they're going to, you know, address all fast mana, maybe throw in Simeons and Temples. I think it's going to be a better ban because of it.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope that that's what's going on here. I hope it's more of a we want to take our time and address the situation properly and less of a we don't want to admit that we royally screwed up. But I get that same kind of impression that this is them behind the scenes calculating the right way to handle this. And I mean, I think most people agree that banning I is probably the route they're going to take, and that's the best route to just shut the deck down. But maybe they're playtesting and seeing if they can hit something else to just weaken the deck a little bit and not really try to give it that huge blow. But yeah, so I mean, overall, the Eldrazi, I think we've all talked it to death, but it is good to check in on it and see where it's at. So that's the current Eldrazi situation. Somewhat better, but still horrible. So, moving on down here, they just announced, when did this announcement go up, Alex? This was about a week ago, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so they announced that we're going to have sealed leagues coming to MTGO. I just recently started messing with leagues in general, and this is pretty cool. I'm excited they're going to be doing sealed just because the league experience so far has been pretty nice. It's a good way to kind of jam those games out that you would normally do in like the open play area, but with a little bit more weight to them. I can dig it. But yeah, so I mean, the overview here for these sealed leagues, we're looking at, it's going to be 28 tickets to enter. You can also enter with six packs and four ticks, or just 280 of the play points. The one thing that kind of stuck out to me that I don't know how I feel about it is you have a limited amount of time to for deck construction.
Oh, yeah. Like, normally when you do, like, a sealed, just, like, one-shot sealed event on there, you get, like, 10 minutes or so. But, like, that's actually, like, they don't give you enough time on that. Like, sometimes it's, you know, 10 or 15 minutes, I forget how long it is exactly, but it's just, it's so quick. Like, you can only run through, like, one or two iterations of your pool. Mm. You can only be like, oh, I think it's just this. Let me look at this other color really quick. Oh, I don't got time. I'm going with this. So, like, because it is for, you know, you're paying a lot to do this, and there's some decent prizes, too. I like that they're going to give you time to, you know, check all your options, see if, like, initially looking at it, green might be look like your strongest color, but as you go through it again, you might be like, oh, no, I think white's better, and you can change things around. So I kind of like it.
Yeah, the only thing that stuck out to me, like, I mean, more time's fine. I've never really played sealed on MTGO, so I haven't had experience with that. But just playing sealed in paper, I want to say usually you have about 20 to 30 minutes. I've never paid too much attention, but that's always felt about right. The only issue I really have with this gives you plenty of time to, like, send out pictures of your sealed pool to people and crowdsource your deck, basically.
It does. And
I mean, that could be a good thing, though, too. If everybody's playing, like, the best version of their sealed pool, it's good competition.
That's true.
They're trying to keep to the good old nature of the leagues is to, you know, be able to play on your own schedule, be able to play on your own
right.
time. This is also a really good tool to help your sealed game. Some people just don't get enough practice for it in and don't get enough serious competition with it. It's a great tool right here. I absolutely love it.
And that's true. That's a good point. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't something that really bugged me. It just kind of stuck out to me. Just being like, whenever I'm looking at MTGO things, I tend to make notes of things that vary versus paper or its paper closest paper equivalent, and that's something that stuck out a lot. But I mean, nah, you guys make some good points. I think that is a pretty good tool for players who are newer to sealed. And I mean, even for me, I've done a few sealed events, but I could definitely use some dusting off on that. Alex mentioned the payout. Payout's pretty nice. They've increased it a little bit, and they didn't make any mention, though, about this applying to other leagues, did they?
No, it's just this one because it costs more to play.
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, so, I mean, you're looking at, with just three wins, you'll get a booster out of it, 140 of the play points. With four wins, you're going to get three boosters and 280 of the play points. And then five wins, you get a full six boosters and 420 of the play points. With these also, too, you get, what are the QPs?
Those are qualifier points.
It's for the mocks.
Okay. Yep. Nice. And, I mean, those are tacked on in the typical. Are those more than you would get out of the other leagues?
No. It's the same. Those are same.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so, I mean, looking at it, though, overall, this is pretty sweet. I mean, considering it costs 280 to play, four wins get you another round, which that's typical for the leagues, right? I want to say for the other league payouts, four wins typically get you another go-around, but this one's a little bit more significant since you're going to have some cards you're getting out of it also, you know?
In the other ones, it's only three wins gets you back in.
Gotcha.
Three wins keeps you infinite. Four is a little extra. Five is amazing.
Yeah, so four to go again, but like I said, I mean, you're getting six packs of the sealed pool, too.
It's more
so.
Than go again. It's 280 points, which gets you go again, but it's three boosters, which are the boosters for a draft, so then your next draft only costs like two tickets or whatever, too.
True,
so
that's a good point. It's a little more. I forgot about the boosters as well. Yeah, no, that's awesome. I mean, the payout's really good. This looks nice. It's very enticing. I mean, they've done a good job so far with leagues in general. The payouts are pretty good. And, I mean, that's what I think people wanted. I mean, it's a good replacement for sort of the – I don't even remember what they were called, where you could go in and pay, like, two ticks to do a 1v1 and, like, winner got a pack or something.
They're just called two-mans. Yeah. They still have them.
Yeah, and now they're still up there, but they always felt kind of miserable. Like, it just didn't feel like really any point to it. You know what I mean?
I mean, you can grind points pretty easy that way, because like it's 20 points to play, winner gets 30, loser gets 50, so you can just rack up points if you're just really good with your deck.
Gotcha. Yeah, I haven't touched them since the play points became a thing, but my biggest point is it just felt like these are a pretty good replacement product for that. I mean, instead of, you know, dirtling around and playing one game, I might as well do a league and hop in that, put a little bit more stakes into it.
Yeah, I gotta agree with that.
Yeah, so I mean, overall, definitely cool. These are firing up tomorrow after the downtime, which tomorrow for us, yeah, so this will post tomorrow, so it'll be today. So if you're listening to this on Wednesday, then they're already up if the downtime's already occurred. If you're one of the quick listeners and checking out Tuesday night, these will be up tomorrow.
March 2nd, if you want a specific date.
Yeah, there you go. Nice. The leap year's throwing me off. I have no idea what day of the month it is. But all right, moving on down here. So the next one was Unraveling the Madness, which this has been posted up on Wizard sites. And really, I mean, it's a countdown for when the official spoiler season is starting. Do you think that this has anything to do with all of the leaks that we've had recently?
I really think it does.
Well, they said they put out that statement when the leaks happened that they're going to say official spoiler season and things like that. And they're sticking to that. And I like it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a fun way to do it. Like, I'm glad that it's not... It doesn't feel like them putting a heavy hand down and saying, look, we're shutting down these leaks. Instead, it looks like, look, we're going to, you know, bulk up what we do for spoiler season, make it more of an event. I think that's awesome.
So are other people, like, say, like Channel Fireball, Star City Games, are they going to get their own spoilers still? Or is this just a pure Wizards thing now?
I'm assuming people are going to get... Because, like, before, you know, people would get their individual... spoilers, like the YouTube guys and the streamers and stuff would get like their card to talk about or whatever. I'm assuming that's still going to happen. It's just going to be on a more set schedule, probably.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, the impression that I'm getting from this is that Wizards is going to fire off with their own spoiler starting, you know, when the countdown ends, and then we'll see spoilers start to leak out, or not leak out, that's a bad way to put it, but we'll start seeing spoilers from other third parties after that. I mean, this is kind of nice. It gives them the ability to kind of kick it off on their own terms, and then the others can spoil their cards they've received. Yeah, I mean, so looking at the times, this is going to be Thursday this week, 7 p.m. Eastern time, so 6 p.m. Central, and math can determine the rest of that for the West Coast. to our Australia listeners, I have no idea, so it's on you.
Come on, we need a good Tybalt. This needs to happen. First spoiler, good Tybalt. Calling it.
Right out of the gate?
Calling my shots, good Tybalt, right out the gate.
All right, I mean, we'll see. Maybe it'll be a flip Tybalt. A flip Tybalt.
Flip Tybalt, ugh.
All right, so next up, speaking of sets coming out, we've got Conspiracy still on the radar, but man, they've been killing it with the marketing for this thing. I mean, I think when we first talked about it was still the original name, which was
Reign of Braga,
right? So then on the official Twitter, you get a picture of Braga getting knifed and then a name change for the set. And now, well, at that time, it was being called Empty Throne, which, like, yep. Great already. And then they released the card count in the set with the original name and then with the new name, and they reduced it by one. So I think we can all assume that that was Braga getting literally stabbed out of the set. Pretty awesome. Yep. Like, I mean, just from a flavor standpoint, this is sweet. I don't think we've seen anything really marketed this heavily from Wizards. I mean, I know Conspiracy, like, they did some pretty cool stuff with the Magister of War that popped out during, like... Was that sealed events for the set prior to it, right?
It was, they put like one in a pack that somebody opened and it had like a code on the back that was a website. And the website was another code and you had to decipher it and that got you the text for another card. Like, yeah. It was crazy.
Yeah, I think it was one of the first conspiracy type cards to the actual
The weird conspiracy mechanic.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I mean, so that was pretty cool. It's cool to see him stepping it up, because then since then now we have a new name change, which now the set is being called Take the Crown, and we're back up to 221 cards, the original set number. So,
but to note, that's like, it's probably not Braga, because like the assassin that's in the that. Knifed Braga is now sitting on the throne on like the new promotional art, and the set went up one, so it's probably this assassin is the card that got added. So like, who knows how long this is going to go on.
Yeah, we still have quite a while before this set comes out, so we could be seeing many, many more name changes before this officially drops. I mean, they have to have a normal card count. I mean, 221 seems kind of odd. I feel like 220 is going to end up being the official card count. We're going to be playing this game for a while up until then.
It's not unheard of for Wizards of the Coast to make an odd card count. Like, I'll go back and in a different card game on this one. Back in the original Team Rocket Pokemon expansion, they had a bonus card that was hidden in Dark Raichu to add a number one, like a 121st out of 120 cards or something like that.
Huh.
So Wizards has done it before. And it'd be pretty sweet to see it again if they like, okay, we got 220 out of 220, and then we're going through our cards and we pick up one that says 221 out of 220. What?
Yeah, and I mean, for a conspiracy set, like, this is there. I think we're seeing more and more indication that the unsets are gone, and maybe this is going to be one of the replacements for it, just because it's nice for them to have this area where they can play around and goof off with card design, and even with how they're marketing the set and kind of break up the, you know, the sort of monotony of standard and the competitive grind. I mean, nah, it's getting me excited for it, that's for sure.
And but, to go with that, like, the set code for, you know, sets, they all have their little code,
right,
like cons and all that. This one is just CN2, which is roughly, you know, probably Conspiracy 2. Con, so it doesn't have any indication of what the final name will be.
Right, yeah, so they could do this as much as they want. No clues right there, which is awesome. And, I mean, they could be leaving all kinds of breadcrumbs leading to nothing, too. So, nah, this is awesome. We've got, what, August is the release for this, so we've got some time still. Let them have their fun. I'm enjoying it, and I'll probably be drafting this set at least once when it comes out. But moving on down here to something a little more serious. So for the next Pro Tour, we're going to be seeing a change in sideboarding. It's essentially really the change. All that we're going here is when we're in the finals, and the finals for the Pro Tour is always five rounds instead of three. So you're playing best out of the five. So now, instead of sideboarding after game one, you're going to play game two with your original 60 main deck as well, and then sideboard for 3-4, you know, but all the potential games following. So, I mean, it's adding an additional game pre-sideboard. This one's an interesting change. I can dig it a little bit, but
I got a nit.
I like it because it takes away the advantage of one person having just sideboard hoser cards.
Yeah,
they absolutely get four games with sideboard hoser cards. It makes it a little more fair.
Okay, that's reasonable. But my negative on that is, like, we don't, some decks shouldn't be allowed to go that many games like that. Like, if you get, like, say, you know, for some reason Storm comes back in Modern, we have a Modern Pro Tour, and Storm's in the finals, and the opponent has no real hate for Storm because he's the only one person in the room playing it. He's going to get two free wins. He'll have three games after that to really just put together and win one game. I'm not a fan of that, and I think it kind of lurches towards combo and aggro being a slightly better decision in your Pro Tours and such.
Yeah, I think it's going to be hard to see how this affects deck construction, if at all. I mean, if you look at it, I mean, like Alex mentioned, you're playing to three wins, so if you're a deck who is heavily affected by a strong sideboard card, you're getting the really rough end of the deal right now. You're getting one game to beat them up, and then you got four games to try to fight through sideboard to try to get two wins, assuming you won game one. So you're still playing more sideboard games than you are without sideboard, 3-2, I mean, assuming you go full five rounds. But it does seem like it kind of evens that balance a little bit between the two. And I think that's probably what they're going for here is, yes, you can potentially win two games in a row if you're the favorite before sideboard, but then you still do have to pick up that third win. I mean, it's just tricky. Like, it gives the edge to the three sideboard games, but then at the same time, you don't always play that many. That's only if you go to five. So I think it does a decent balancing job of trying to not give advantage to one style over the other. You know what I mean? I mean, it's a tricky kind of thing to hit.
It's tough to balance in the end. I mean, it's still, you know, variance applies in all card games, and it's a tough balance. And I like to see it. I mean, I don't play the Pro Tour, but I would like to one day. I mean, this is a nice change.
Yeah, I mean, it's always interesting to see them shake things up, and maybe this would be a good change. It's the hardest thing about this is really, like, you can't, it's hard to analyze it from a high level perspective because each matchup between two individual decks is going to be affected by this so differently. I mean, there's going to be plenty of matchups where this means next to nothing. Each person's bringing in, you know, two or three cards, whatever. And then, like you said, I mean, you have decks that perform better pre-sideboard, then you have decks that perform way better post-sideboard. I mean, I don't know. It'll be interesting, I guess. That's really the best we can say about it right now, right?
I mean, I think overall it's going to be better. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think right now decks that are favored post-sideboard get a pretty big advantage considering potential four games to one being played that way. So I think that this is their way to try to hedge that a little bit and balance it out. And it's something that's impossible to balance, so they're never going to hit the perfect answer. But I think this might be more reasonable than what we have right now. So good on them for trying something, right? But all right, going down the list here, the next item from the vault lore, which is maybe the most vague name you could give a From the Vault set, right?
I think they're running out of ideas, but I do love these boxes. These are some this is some of my favorite premium stuff right here.
As a non-foil guy, I'm pretty much excluded from the vaults entirely.
We are going to talk about it in segment two of the reserve list, but FTV sets are known for bringing back reserve list cards because they are premium select cards. So you might see a reserve list or hear one or two copies of them.
Have we seen a reserve list card in a From the Vault before?
Give me a second here. I can find that right now.
That's
From the Vault, Relics had Masticore, and From the Vault Exiled had both Memory Jar and Mox Diamond.
That's crazy. So did we see any backlash when that happened?
No, because that was when the original... You know what? We'll hold off on that until segment two.
Yeah, we'll get into this.
We'll get into that subject there. But
that's real interesting, though. I didn't know that. That surprised me. I hadn't heard that before. So, okay, anyway. Next segment. So, on our current From the Vault lore, I mean, I feel like From the Vault is already implying that we're digging into old cards, and lore implies the same kind of thing. So, not a solid theme here, but at the same time, I kind of dig it because I feel like with Annihilation and Angels and all these name sets, the name implies so much about the cards that you get some real duds in these sets. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you can. definitely. But
I mean, the little tagline they put out on this one is, this limited edition set includes cards from throughout Magic's history that are renowned for both their power and the stories behind them. I think it's kind of going with Wizards push to do more story-based sets and story-driven, you know, narratives and things like that.
Like, I could see, like, you know, we could have, like, an Una Queen of the Fae in this set, you know, kind of appease the Commander players. More of a story side, I could see them having an Ignite Memories from back in the Pro Tour with Patrick Chapin and who else was it? The French guy. I can't think of his name off the top of my head. But, you know, we would have the... That's kind of my thought, what's going to go into it. Like, it'd be funny if we saw Stormcrow. Like, that would be premium foil Stormcrow.
That's not funny at all.
I was thinking maybe they'll go, because they're talking about stories, they might go into, like, the Brothers War or, like, the Weatherlight, the crew of the Weatherlight. We could see, like, a Gerard in this or something, you know. I was thinking legacy kind of those weapon. Kind of stories, too.
Ooh, Legacy Weapon would be pretty crazy. Dark Depths would be pretty crazy. I always thought Merit Lage was like one of the coolest stories. It's pretty vague, and there's not much to it as far as I know, but it's a sweet card. Yeah, so, I mean, that's cool. Like I said, I can dig it. I think sometimes the themes make them too constrained, so having something a little more vague would be nice. And yeah, Alex, that's an awesome point. Like, they really are trying to push the stories of Magic, and this could be a pretty decent way to set up something they want to revisit or just things they want to highlight from the past for people to check out. But either way, no, it's definitely cool. I mean, it's almost sort of a meta set in the name, just with lore, just sort of self-referential. But nah, I dig it a bunch. So before we get out of this segment, we're coming up on time here, but we want to talk a little bit more about the finance of Magic the Gathering. So which one do you guys want to talk some finance?
I'll go.
I can take this one.
Okay, go ahead.
I've kind of got four cards here that I want to talk about, just in general. Some standard, mostly standard, and then one modern. But I think right now is the time to buy Sylvan Advocate. It started at $3. It's currently at $5 TCG mid. But after rotation, the best fixing to get your two colors will be Manlands, and he works so well with Manlands. And also, he's just the premier non-Jace 2-drop. He's the best 2-drop that's not Jace, in my opinion.
I can dig it.
Yeah, what do you think about that one, Jerry?
3 is a safe buy-in, so I mean, it's not unreasonable to pitch in $3 to pick some of these up. You said...
Well, he's at 5 now. He's 5 now. He was 3, so he's already gone up some. Okay. I see him hitting 10 pretty easy.
And what's the rarity on this card?
He's rare.
It is a rare, yep.
Okay. So, yeah, so, I mean, that's a pretty reasonable pickup. $5 isn't too bad. And, I mean, really, even, too, when you're looking at trades, just get them in as add-ins just in case. Who knows?
Looking at it from a power standpoint, as far as Type 2 and Standard goes, Elvish Warriors were almost always playable, and this one is pushed as hard as they've done. So there's no reason this shouldn't be a contender in the 2-drop spot for all green decks. And I think it'll also be on the rise.
Nice. What else you got, Alex?
So I have on here Watch. Just kind of keep an eye on, see if it drops. If it drops, pick it up. If it starts going high, maybe sell. But Watch, Liliana, Heretical Healer. Currently it's $15 TCG mid. And that's mostly because of Rally. That's the only really deck that plays it right now. So when Rally rotates out, it may come down a little bit. But it also works with Madness coming out of the new set, because when it flips, the +1 is each player discards a card. So it allows you to fuel Madness. With that, it also fuels Delirium, because you can choose what goes into the graveyard to set up your Deliriums. And then on top of it, when she flips, she makes a zombie, and they're pushing zombies in Innistrad as well. Nice. So I could see this also creeping up.
Yeah, lots of room for it to blend in with the new set. And I mean, they've admitted in the past, and you can see it in design, that they set up cards from some sets to blend well with the future sets. And I mean, who better to blend in with Innistrad than Liliana? So yeah, I mean, that's definitely a good one to keep an eye on. What else you got?
So then I have a speculation one here. It's Risen Executioner, which was a mythic from Dragons. So it's going to survive the rotation. It's currently only $2.15 on TCG mid, which is really low for mythic. I could be wrong. It could just be a bulk mythic. I'm not going to, say it's not. But because they've already spoiled zombie cards in Innistrad. And Risen Executioner is a zombie lord, so it gives all their zombies +1/+1. And has graveyard recursion. You can cast it from your graveyard if you pay one more for each creature also in your graveyard. So it's a recurrable lord, which is very rare. And for a relevant type that's coming up in the next set.
Nice, yeah. And I mean, mythics are some of my favorite spec targets, especially these cheap mythics, just because all it takes is if it gets included in a good 4-of deck that hits a top 8, you're in the money. Like, and it's not very risky at just a little over $2 each. You got one more?
And with that one too, that was the least open cons set. Cons was cracked a lot for fetches, so like that was also the least open set of that block, so that'll help it too. And the last one here is Sell Arcbound Ravager. It's currently $55 TCG mid. It's held steady like 25 for years.
Yeah.
It's only high right now because the affinity competes with Eldrazi. Once Eldrazi gets banned, there's no need for that. The price will start coming back down.
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense. And I mean, yeah, if you're playing Affinity and you're doing well with it, hang on to them. But you got some sitting in the binder. I mean, it's hard to imagine this thing's going to hit prices this high again for a long time. I mean, it should be returning to around 25 after the Eldrazi ban. And yeah, I mean, it may creep up slowly over time. But for something to go up that much is pretty significant. We don't see it that often. Usually the market can't hold a price like that long. So yeah, once Eldrazi goes, this thing's going to plummet back to where it was. And yeah. Get it while the getting's good.
All right. I'd like to definitely talk about two cards as well.
Yeah, go for it.
I got Nissa, Voice of Zendikar. In the most recent open for Standard, it was played as a 4-of in 2 different top 8 decks. Huh. They were both hardened scales lists. But right now it's at about $13 on average. And it's more of a speculation call, but another relevant type in Innistrad was humans, fast aggro humans, and even some mid-range version of werewolves or even fast werewolves. This card would fit very well into those lists, and 3 mana to pump the entire team is relevant to those cards. So I say this is something to speculate on. It's a more riskier pickup than, say, Risen Executioner, because I might be wrong, but I'd look into it. And the other card I want to talk about is Eye of Ugin. It's in a weird place right now, where we're pretty sure it's going to get banned in Modern, but the card is super playable in Legacy too, and it's not OP there. So, will it maintain its price? Will it drop? Will it raise? It's such a weird location right now that I'm not 100% sure where we should either pick them up or get rid of them. What are your guys' thoughts?
What's the price currently at?
They beat around $40 and $45 currently.
What were they before Eldrazi?
Wow. Before Eldrazi?
They were like 10 to 20, so yeah, they weren't that high.
Yeah.
I say get rid of them. it's the one that's going to get banned, and I don't think Legacy is going to hold the prices for it.
No, yeah. I mean, it seems pretty clear that a big chunk of that price comes from the Eldrazi deck. So, I mean, if it's the one that gets banned. Now, the interesting side to that, though, is if something else gets banned from that Eldrazi deck, then it's really hard to say.
Like, say they just ban Eldrazi Mimic and then, wow, $70-$80. That'd be crazy.
Yeah, because despite, like, it's clear that it got a price bump from this, but also I think most people are expecting it to get banned, so that should be holding the price down some, too. I mean, if there was no imminent ban coming for this thing, price would probably be
there's a demand for it. Yeah, there's a demand, and everybody wants to play the Eldrazi deck, so they need them.
No, there's a huge demand, but there's got to be a pretty good chunk of players who would like to play the Eldrazi deck but aren't going to invest in it because of the fact that the imminent, you know, like, it seems like it's going to get banned any day now. So, I mean, true. That could be holding the price down a little bit. I mean, I think the most likely scenario is that it gets banned, so I wouldn't invest in them at this point. If you've got them, I mean, it seems good to move them, like Alex said. I mean, you're going to get a pretty decent chunk of change out of it, and they're probably going to fall down to about what they were post-banning. But then again, Legacy does affect it some with the Eldrazi deck popping up in Legacy now, but it's not going to support that whole entire price increase, maybe half of it, a third of it, a fourth of it. I mean, who knows? But it all depends on how much more showings we see from that deck in Legacy in the time. But I would say watch it is the best I would say right now. I mean, if you want a quick buck, I don't think moving it right now is wrong. I think it would be hard to get that much out of it. If it gets banned in Modern, it's going to drop pretty good. So it's a good time to get out of it if you have some you're not using. So, yeah, mostly just watch it, though, because that one is. I mean, that's a bizarre situation there. But all right, that's going to do it for the finance talk. We're definitely at time for this segment, so we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a minute to talk about the reserve list. All right, welcome back. It is time to talk about the reserve lists. I feel like this has been a pretty hot topic recently. I mean, especially with Legacy support and in regards to Legacy, but really just in regards to Magic at all. And it's kind of a weird thing that's been around for a long, long time at this point. And I mean, a lot of competitive players, a lot of people who are very serious in the game, still only kind of have like fringe knowledge of what the reserve list is, what's on it, why it exists, things like that. And I mean, and this is including me. I mean, I've just never really taken the time to delve into this, so we thought it'd be a great topic for you guys. And so
a big reason we're jumping into it is because Eternal Masters is getting printed. And
I was just about to say the same thing.
Yeah, so I mean, it's a prime for talking about it right now. It's a good time. So, Jerry, what is the reserve list?
The reserve list is a list of cards that will never be reprinted in order to preserve their value. The reprint policy featuring the reserve list was published by WotC on March 4th, 1996. Reserve cards are cards that will never be reprinted again in a functionally identical form. This is a key point right here. Functionally identical form, meaning they will play with cards. They have done this. A card is considered functionally identical to another card if it has the same card type, subtype, ability, mana cost, power, and toughness. Why does it exist?
All right, so before we get into why it exists, I mean, that gives a pretty good summary about the reserve list in general. I mean, I don't want to get into why it exists yet. We'll talk about that in just a second. But there's a lot of good points in there that we'll be talking about, mostly the functional reprint, the functionally identical subclause there, and just really what it means to be considered a functional reprint of the card. But why does the reserve list exist? What's the point of all this?
So the reserve list exists because when 4th edition and Chronicles was printed many, many, many years ago, they printed a lot of cards from the original limited edition Alpha and Beta, and they crushed the market. It's sort of like how Konami treats Yu-Gi-Oh!, how they just kill the secondary market. And this really hurt a lot on the collectors and store owners at the time.
So for people not familiar with 4th Edition and Chronicles, I mean, these featured heavy, heavy amount of reprints, right? I mean,
yes, they featured tons of reprints. Chronicles was printed a ton. It also, like, 4th Edition was the first time, it was one of the first white border sets. You know, that's another thing to put out there, is they didn't want to black border them. They wanted to start this whole white border sort of thing that clearly none of us like.
Yeah,
except you, Bobby, and your basic lands.
That's mostly a joke. But yeah, I mean, so it seems like Wizards was a little bit aware before the printing, because obviously by giving these reprints of cards white borders, the hopes was that the original black borders would carry more of the value, right? I mean, they'd be the original versions, you could tell, which was a first edition printing very easily, but it's still, I mean, I can't imagine like playing during that time and seeing the effect it would have on the value of some of these cards, right? I mean, a mass reprint like that, especially in a set that's seeing tons of reprints, is going to destroy the value of these cards. So, I mean, that's where you see the creation of the reserve list. So, what did the first list look like?
So, the first list included all cards from limited edition Alpha and Beta that had not appeared in 4th edition or Ice Age.
Okay.
All uncommon and rare cards from Arabian Nights and Antiquities that had not been reprinted in White Border at the time, i.e. they did not appear in Revised, 4th, or Chronicles. And all rares from Legends in the Dark that had not yet been reprinted in White Border.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a pretty heavy-handed list. That's kind of reminiscent of what WotC does nowadays with the ban list. I mean,
They laid law hard there.
It was just like a blanket. They just want to hit, we're going to hit all the rares. We don't care if they're bulk rares or what. Just blanket them all.
Yeah, and I mean, that seems like a pretty lazy response. I mean, I like the idea, and I know it's controversial, the reserved list in general, but it's tough because you do want to preserve these values. But before we get too much into that, let's talk about some of these revisions. So in 2002, they changed up the reserve list. What did it look like then?
Okay, so at that point, they had been just kind of trying to add sets slowly to it to maintain value. But okay, in 2002, they cut Mercadian Masks off the list. Completely pulled off of it.
Okay.
And they brought back commons and uncommons from Alpha and Beta, but they did this because there was a strong response from the community. It is a key note here. So it means things have changed because of the community. If enough people scream into a vacuum, things will change. And a weird card was pulled off, Faraz's Ban from Homelands. It was pulled off because it was mistakenly already reprinted and put through the machines.
Oh, wow.
And there are a couple key cards here. Like, if we really look at them, these are cards that would have stayed on the list had they not been pulled off. Basalt Monolith, Demonic Tutor, Juggernaut, Psionic Blast, Regrowth, Resurrection, and Sinkhole. All these cards are either have been mainstays in different Type 2 formats, some of them in Vintage, not really so much in Legacy. Basalt Monolith kind of the exception here. But they've all seen some regular play.
Right. So these would have been much more expensive cards had they stayed on the reserve list.
Had they stayed on the reserve list, Mono Black and Legacy would be completely unaffordable. Juggernaut wouldn't have been an inclusion in that crazy red-blue artifact list we had last summer. just different little things like that.
Nice. So then looking forward, then past 2002, at 2010, we had another revision. What happened then?
So select cards could be reprinted as a premium set inclusions, like I had mentioned earlier in the first segment, i.e. dual decks, premium deck series, like premium deck series Slivers, premium deck series Fire and Lightning. You also have your From the Vault sets. So there's just a couple examples of premium sets.
Okay. So what was going on at this time, though? I mean, what was the reaction to Wizards printing some of these cards in these premium sets?
So the one that really startled people was Phyrexian Negator getting reprinted. It was a 3-mana 5/5 that whenever it was dealt damage, you sacked that many permanents. And at the time when it was originally printed, that card kind of was its own house in Standard.
I can see that.
A lot of collectors had copies of these, and they'd be like $20-$25 because, you know, as time goes on, you know, the power levels of cards change depending on what's printed.
Right.
But they were still maintaining a price. And when this had happened, they were like, oh no, they're going to break the reserve list rule, incoming duels. But that didn't happen. WotC did a really good job of keeping track of how many cards they wanted to reprint and such.
Yeah, it almost seems like a way for them to establish this weird sort of precedent where they do it with a card that no one's going to make a huge uproar about. So now they have established that it's essentially okay for them to reprint these cards in premium sets. Now, I mean, obviously, if we saw something like duels printed in like a duel deck, you know, 5-color fun and it has all the duels in it, people would lose their minds and we'd see huge repercussions. But I don't know how this would hold up. I mean, there's a clear precedent here that essentially they've said we can do this, and the community, by reacting in that way, has almost said, like, yeah, that's fine. So, I mean, this is an interesting clause to it, and one that I, you know, as you heard in the first segment, completely caught me off guard. I had no idea, just because this sort of seems to almost negate the reserve list in general. I mean, there's not really a set rule on what these dual decks or what these premium decks or even like from the Vault series. I mean, yes, they're limited run, but how limited do they really have to be to maintain that premium, you know, product title?
Well, they didn't have to be, but another thing to note about all these extra sets is they cost money. You know, From the Vault Realms is a $70 buy.
Yeah.
You know, some of these, they're not cheap. This is not, I mean, it's a slightly easier way to get a hold of these cards, but at the same time, you're still putting out money, and they're alternate versions. They are not original. They are completely altered.
Yeah, the only thing, though, is, I mean, Wizards sets the MSRP on these products, so they're only expensive because Wizards charges a high price, and they're only in the posts, you know, in the secondary market, the price increases on the better from the Vault sets because of the supplied by Wizards. But again, Wizards controls both of those things, and I don't know if we have any real, like, rule set on what the MSRP has to be or what the print run has to be for it to be considered premium. I mean, it's just something interesting that they may have set up here for them. But what else we got about the reserve list? What happened after this in 2010?
Well, nothing has really changed since then. We've had, you know, several cards put on it that we never thought we'd see again, like certain Judge foils that were released, like Survival of the Fittest, Phyrexian Dreadnought, and Wheel of Fortune. Those were put out there. Mox Diamond, Memory Jar, Master Core, like I mentioned earlier, those were on the reserve list. I mean, Memory Jar is not even legal. Why is this a huge deal? Why should it not be reprinted? That type of thing. Another way they were able to play around with it is like in their online cube, how it was a Phantom cube. They pull cards off the reserve list to put on the online cube. I mean, they're not actual physical copies, and people get to play with them. So that, you know, the cards maintain their value, and it's kind of a little cop out there in the discussion, but it's another point to make. You know, it's another way to play with these insanely expensive cards.
Yeah, and I mean, it shows that Wizards is, I mean, they've got to be dreadfully aware of this reserve list, and it seems like it's almost like it's a bear in the room that they've poked as much as they can, and they want to see how much more they can get away with, right? I mean, they've printed some of these cards from the Vault sets, which would, like, logic would say that that's a clear violation of the reserve list. MTGO, you get into a much grayer area. I mean, that's hard to say. It's not really, no one's really collecting on MTGO. Like, so, I mean, that's, you know, not much consequence there. But yeah, reserve list is in a pretty interesting spot right now, and it makes sense why there's so much divisiveness about this. Alex, what are your thoughts on how the reserve list sits right now, just sort of in general?
Because there is so much talk about, you know, people want the reserve list gone because they don't, like, they weren't around. So, like, when this started in 96, the first reserve list, it was because there was just as many collectors as players. Like, back then, there were collectible card games is what they were called. It's because people would collect these to keep them, to retain value, like baseball cards and things like that. So, like, it was a different mentality. Now people are just here to play. And, like, with standard rotating, like, they just want to, you know, get their standard deck, get rid of it, move on. And they just want this constant rotation, so they don't understand how this affects other people. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting spot because, like you mentioned, I mean, most cards at the time when Magic was first coming into the scene weren't attached to a game. They were just collectibles. And Magic was sort of one of the first in this breed of collectible card games. And, I mean, I think Pokemon was set up as that as well, as a trading card game. I mean, but really, I mean, since then, times have changed a lot, and the collection side of Magic doesn't really, I mean, it does exist, obviously, but from cards being printed now, Wizards is setting a pretty clear precedence of we're reprinting things, we're trying to keep prices down. It's not really a collector's market as much, and when you think about it being a collector's market, you're mostly looking at reserve list cards, older cards, things that you don't think are going to be reprinted. You're not really looking at standard staples at all. It's very obvious and clear that those are not meant to be collectibles. Those are churn and burn sort of cards. They're going to be hot for a while and the price is going to drop. So it does, it's kind of this weird identity crisis that Magic is going through right now. And I mean, the reserve list made perfect sense back then. I mean, who knows what would have happened to the game, because a lot of the money that supported Magic at the beginning and that pushed it to what it is now came from collectors that would have had no interest in this if these things were being reprinted every opportunity they had. So, I mean, it's interesting looking at like where the reserve list was, but it's, I think we can all agree that this is a problem for Legacy, right? This is a problem for Eternal formats in general.
Yeah, it's a problem because it creates a gigantic price barrier. You have to put down money equivalents like a down payment on a car or a vacation home. That shouldn't be a thing in our collectible card game.
And now,
I don't think it should be.
Yeah, not to interrupt you, sorry, but I mean, looking at Legacy, like, we've seen a detrimental effect, right?
Yes, but the numbers have taken a hit. Another thing people will say is because if the reserve list goes, more people will flock in and then the supply will be gone. There was a point made on a recent Channel Fireball article that it would take numbers in the 100,000 people to have place at all the duels before we start actually having that conversation. So the cards are out there. They just, because they're not reprinted, price continues to climb.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's Magic cards and collectibles in general are kind of this weird thing where price isn't always just supply and demand. There's also this asterisk next to it saying that price is affected by what you expect to happen in the market, what you plan on happening in the market. And the fact that these cards are, as of now, never going to be reprinted, they're holding extra value that isn't actually there. It isn't actually represented by demand or supply. It's just a value that's sitting there because people know that it's inevitable that these cards are going to go up in value. So if I have something for, you know, $140 right now that I know is only going to go up in value unless if something insane happens, I have no pressure to sell that today. You know, I mean, obviously there's other outside influences. People come under bad times, but just from the standpoint of, if no one wants to give me $140 today, I can sit on it. It might be worth $150 next year. It might go up even more than that. So it adds this extra influence on the price that isn't actually represented by any, like, the real basic economics. So the reserve list is just a bizarre thing. I mean, there's not really anything to compare it to in the realm of other card games or collectibles or anything else, right? I mean, it's a pretty unique beast.
Nah, it's unique to MTG. There's not one for anything else.
Yeah, so, I mean, overall, though, it does. It puts us at this weird spot, but we've seen a little bit of precedence from Wizards reprinting some of these cards, but we don't know what the legal consequences are of this. Now, Alex has done some serious, top-notch investigation on this. So, Alex, tell us about...
By serious, top-notch investigation, you mean I took a business law class in college. Like, it's right. Not...
Yeah, you know, and he had a few beers earlier, and he took to Google, and he's discovered some very hard-hitting facts about promissory estoppel. So, Alex, bring us up to speed. What do you got?
All right, so the American Law Institute in 1932 included the principle of estoppel, stating, this is legalese, so I'll break it down for you after right. I read this statement.
Nice and slow.
Yeah. A promise which the promisor should reasonably expect to induce action or forbearance of a definite and substantial character on the part of the promisee, which does not induce such action or forbearance, is binding if injustice can be avoided only by enforcement of the promise. So this is, you know, 1932
right?
Legal
super
speak.
Clear. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
No confusion
so,
there.
And for like a real world example to kind of clear up what this says, it's basically... So Chris, we joked about it before in a previous podcast and stuff, went to Georgia or wherever he drove to get Who lawn knows? Mowing equipment so he could start mowing lawns and stuff. So let's say Chris promises to mow my yard for $20. And I say, sure, I agree to it. I promise to pay him $20 when the job is done. Chris forgets that I now live in Illinois. So he has to travel all the way here to Illinois. He mows my yard. And he tries to charge me like a travel fee for, you know, him coming from Virginia to Illinois.
Right.
The travel fee is not part of the original promise. So he's only entitled to the $20 that I promised him. I'll say, you know, I said I'd give you $20 at the end of the job. You get $20. This is basically what promissory estoppel is. It's a form of oral agreement that I promise one thing, you promise one thing. We agree to meet these promises and hold up both ends of it. So what does this mean for WotC? Is basically they promised that I'd never reprint the cards on the reserve list. And we as the players and the collectors agreed with that. We said, yes, this is what we want. So if they ever were to reprint these cards, like not in these premium loopholes and things like that, every collector of Magic the Gathering, every person who's ever bought a pack of Magic or owns a Magic card that they got as a gift or whatever, would be entitled to compensation for this. So, like, typical court, they're usually small claims, you know, business on business, you know, construction and things like that that goes on. But the claims range from like $1,000 to $5,000 on average. It can go higher depending on damages of what is actually involved. So basically, in order for Wizards to go get away from the reserve list, is they would have to compensate every Magic player for whatever the court determines the damages are. And because these reserve list cards are so expensive, it'd be Wizards paying out, you know, $1,000 to $5,000 to every Magic player.
All right, so huge asterisk to that is I just want to point out that I think this court case would be completely insane. I mean, we've got so
many. It would take time. It would be a huge class action lawsuit. It would take years to settle. But that's also another problem is if it takes years to settle, this is going to get in the media. And then Joe Schmo can run to Walmart, buy a pack. Now he's a collector and he gets to hop on this lawsuit.
Yeah, I mean, but even just looking at payouts and stuff, this is all based on what we've seen so far. But I think that we would be dealing with a completely insanely new scenario with this. And I think Wizards knows that. I mean, the bottom line of this is they did make a promise when they created the reserve list. And it did have a very specific point. I think it was very clear to consumers that this is to hold the value of these cards. And by breaking this, we would be really, you know, going against your trust and against our promise. So there would be some serious legal recourse here. What that looks like, I don't think a crack team of 20 lawyers could tell you, to be honest. I mean,
right.
Just because it's such a weird gray area.
It's going to be a huge lawsuit. Like, you know, it's going to be, you know, hundreds of thousands of people will hop on it. It would be insane. It would go to court. They would have to determine, you know, how many of these people on the lawsuit get how much. And, like, it would just be a giant shit show.
Yeah. So, I mean, looking at it from Wizards' point of view here, it makes perfect sense why they don't want to touch this thing. To be completely honest, the fact that they printed something in a From the Vault set, that's why it surprised me so much to hear that, was just because it seems like that should have been a much, much bigger deal. That should be something we still hear about to this day. And the fact that they didn't really suffer any real legal consequences for that is honestly, I mean, pretty enticing. I mean, it makes it feel like they might have more wiggle room here than most of us thought. So,
well, see, that's the problem, though, too, is they could think they have wiggle room, but, like,
but who knows, yeah.
Because this is something that can be brought up by anyone, like, if they went ahead and were like, hey, we'll get rid of the reserve list, promise not to sue us, and, like, three people are like, no, I'm suing you, like, then they still have to deal with it.
Yeah, and I think one of the most interesting aspects of this, too, is if this were just Wizards versus consumers, that would already be a mess, and that's what we've talked about so far. But you also have Star City Games involved with this. You have Channel Fireball. I mean, now you have tons of third-party companies that spend a lot of their money investing in these cards and reselling them, and they actually would have good legal teams to take Wizards to court over. I mean, these companies could suffer some pretty serious losses if these cards were reprinted and they had tons of them in stock at the time. So, I mean, yeah, it's just a bizarre situation, and it's tricky for Wizards to navigate this. And I'll always say, like, when reserve list things come up and when we talk about reserve list, like, I always completely understand Wizards' point of view on this. I mean, at the end of the day, Legacy is an older format. They're not seeing much support for it. I understand why they wouldn't want to take legal risks to try to reduce this price of entry into Legacy.
Well, it's like, there's the legal risk too, but there's just so much money to be lost there. Like, just the payouts they would have to make, like, it would bankrupt them as a company. We'd lose Magic. Like, that's why I feel like, yes, the reserve list became a problem, and yes, I want to see it gone, but it just can't happen. Like, legally, it just can't and will not happen, and that's the end of it. We can talk about it all day, but it just can't happen.
It's got Shroud. Can't touch it.
Yeah. It got Shroud.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, yeah, that's really, I mean, and I think that's what I really wanted to hark on for listeners is, like, yes, the reserve list, like, at the time, It made sense for them to do it. In retrospect, it was a bad idea. But then again, if it saved the game, then is it a good idea? Yeah, probably. I mean, I'd rather have Magic with a reserve list than no Magic at all, that's for sure. But yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just there's so many weird things that would be involved. And I can guarantee Wizards has already had they've had lawyers taking a look. They could probably use some wizards to look at it too. But I'm sure they've had people. Yeah. I'm sure they've had people looking at this and seeing what they can get away with. I mean, this has got to be a nightmare for them too whenever they want to print a new card that gets close to the functionality of a card on the reserve list, because what dictates, I mean, we've got a pretty good layout here of what determines if it's functionally the same, but that's still a bit subjective, right? I mean,
it is, because some of the cards
on how much has to change.
Like, right.
Obviously the name has to change, but like, what if we change the type now that we've introduced Diamond as colorless? Can we make, you know, like a Force of Will that costs 3 diamond and 2 blue or something like that?
Yeah. Is that enough? Can I call it the Force? And everything else is the same?
Like, I mean, it's such a weird place because some of the cards on the reserve list are so generic. Like, for example, the card Narwhale. It's 2 generic, 2 blue for a 2/2 with protection from red and, if I'm not mistaken, flying. Give me a quick look here. Disregard. Burst Strike. First Strike, Pro Red, 2/2 for 4. They can never reprint those abilities on a card, on a blue card. There's a 3/3 flyer for 4 in red. They can never reprint that. Like, it's so weird how some of these little cards from way back when that have no real standpoint in any format outside of limited, how it affects the way they make cards today.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they could do another update. Maybe to the reserve list here and take those kind of cards off. Like, they've done updates before, made revisions, pulled McKinney masks off because that's it sucked. But they could do things like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's, and like I said, we've seen them tinker with it already. We've seen them print some cards that are, you know, they have some similar functionality to things on it. I mean, it's just bizarre. There's really not much more to say about it than that. It's a bizarre situation. I think Wizards is handling it right. I think you chip away at the reserve list any way you can, and that includes revising it, taking things off that are obviously not intended to be on there, things that aren't worth tons of money, you know, just pull them off the list, and then getting closer and closer to the limits of what is a functional reprint. I mean, I think that's the best route you can take, and I think maybe there's some room. I mean, I would say duels are going to be the big fighting point here, right? I mean, there's tons of cards on this list, but really, you're not going to see a big outcry until you get close to touching those duels. You've got 10 duels. They're all worth, you know, I mean, it ranges depending. The blue ones are always like going to be higher. But once you start hitting that group, that's when you're going to see the biggest outcry of people. That's when you're going to see the biggest people going against it. And I think that's the biggest touchy point for that right now, because in Legacy it's effectively raising the price of almost every single deck in Legacy by a considerable amount, right? So the duels are going to be the interesting thing. That's the Rubicon. That's the point they cross where people lose their minds and all of a sudden we've got a big issue. So I want to see them push that. I want to see how close they can get to a functional reprint.
Exactly.
I think they could do a duel with a drawback, not even necessarily like a shock land. Like, I think it'd have to be like ongoing, like either a Grove of the Burn Willows effect where your opponent gains a life every time you use it for, you know, either one of the manas, but still make it fetchable, obviously. Or the one we were actually talking at the shop the other day. I was playing a tournament and we got on this conversation and somebody brought up a point. I actually like this idea, and it'd actually give them a chance to do more duels. They could run a set of 20. And what it is it's fetchable duel. You'd have Island Swamp, but it would tap for blue. But if you wanted to tap for black, you would have to pay one life. And then you have the opposite of taps for black, but if you want to pay blue, you take one life. And kind of do something like that where there's a drawback, but it's still playable, and people could still run it in Legacy.
Yeah, that's real interesting.
That would be fantastic.
Sweet concept. Yeah, that's actually a pretty good one because, yeah, I mean, really in Legacy, like, that's not the end of the world at all. No, that seems like a good way to go.
So my fix to it is how they do these premium sets. They could do starting with a non-blue duel. Let's start with the worst duel, Plateau.
Hey, no, no.
Print Plateau as a judge foil. See what happens to the community. What happens at this point? Does anyone actually lose their mind over it? You know, I want to see like a reaction. If there's too much of a reaction, don't do it. Stop right there. But start with Plateau. And if there's a small reaction, let's take it up a notch. Let's go to Bayou. You know?
Just keep pushing on.
Just keep pushing. Push the envelope until you hit Volcanic. Let's go with the worst blue duel. Oh, wow, that's a tough one.
It's Tundra.
Oh, yeah. Right. Let's go to the worst blue duel in Tundra. Does that push any buttons?
Yes.
You know?
Absolutely.
See what happens at that point.
I think they missed an opportunity to do that with just making expeditions. Because that's technically premium, right?
Yes, it is. Expeditions are a premium value.
Oh, man. People would have lost their minds.
Yeah. And they would have sold so many packs. People would just buying cases left and right.
And the last time they brought duels into packs was back in original Zendikar when they were releasing them as hidden treasures. You'd get one in a case. Watch the guy pull Scrubland. Watch him pull Scrubland. I'm like, what?
Okay, that's something.
That's nice.
I mean, Candelabra was in there as one. I know I saw a guy pull a Candelabra, and I was like, oh, man.
Yeah, that's a good one. It's a jackpot there. Yeah. But, so I think that's the key, though, is I think you do whatever you can to chip away at them. I mean, the smaller the moves, the better, as long as they're meaningful, just because, that's how you're going to stir the less water. That's how you're going to stir, you get the least amount of reaction from it. But expeditions would have been interesting. I mean, this proposed cycle of sort of a one-sided pain land kind of deal, I think that could do it. That'd be really interesting. I mean, I think that would be enough of an effect that we would see the price on duels come down some. And, that might be another interesting way for Wizards to approach it, is in what ways can you reduce the price of the duels on the reserve list without doing away with the reserve list? A drop in demand for Legacy is certainly one of those things. Then maybe duels that are almost there, that are basically the same, so you really don't suffer much consequence, that should do a pretty number on them too, right?
Yeah. Another thing I want to hit up on with the reserve list is it has this weird bleed effect on certain sets in Magic, like Portal 3 Kingdoms and the original Portal set. These cards are treated as if they are on the reserve list, but they're not. So we have cards with this horsemanship ability that are worth 50, 60 bucks. Imperial Recruiter is worth $200+ because they just won't reprint the card.
Of Will.
Yeah, Force of Will is another card that falls into that same vein. Show and Tell. You know, these cards aren't actually on the list, but they don't want to put them on it. They don't want to reprint them.
A lot of it is those, horsemanship is just a mechanic that was fundamentally wrong. They don't want to deal with it anymore. Same with, banding. So they're yes, they are worth money, but they're not going to be played anyway.
That's true, but, there are other cards in the set, I just use that as an example, but there are other cards in the set that are super playable, but they cost too much money to even get a hold of.
Maybe that changes with Eternal Masters. They already said Force of Will and Wasteland. Maybe we'll get Imperial Recruiter too,
which is fantastic. But Imperial Recruiter
would be great.
Are we going to see Imperial Recruiter? That would be a huge reprint. That needs to happen.
Yeah,
that makes an entire archetype in Legacy that would be a little more prominent because of a 2-card combo. But it can't happen because people just can't afford it. I can't put down
a lot of this reprint that they don't want to do is they don't want it standard.
Yeah, that's something they've been battling with a long time. And, we see that same effect in Modern where you don't want to mess up Standard at the cost of these Eternal formats. But, we're seeing these Eternal Masters products and Modern Masters. I think we're past that era. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they found ways to put cards back into the market, put more cards in without touching Standard. That's always good.
Yeah. Yeah, so, we're coming up here pretty close on time. Do you guys have any final thoughts on this?
I would just like to say that I think Wizards is doing a good job for what they have been doing the past couple years.
Agree,
with making it a more playable card game. It's not collector-based anymore, it's for the players. And they look into that for Standard, not necessarily for Modern and things like that, but they look into it. It's hard, man. They've been doing this for a long time. It's hard to not print, a card in this set that magically combos with this card from a set, 15 years ago or something. And so I think they've done as good a job as they can. I would like them to push, you know, the boundaries that were kind of what we were talking about here, push the boundaries of what they can get away with. Obviously, they can't just do away with the reserve list. We talked about that. But at the same time, man, like, Eternal Masters is great. People have wanted it for a long time. They've done it online. You know, Modo had Vintage Masters and things like that. So I think Wizards is really stepping up their game over the past couple years here, and I'm looking forward to the future.
Jerry, any last thoughts?
Man, it's tough. I do think WotC is also doing a fantastic job. It's very hard to toe the line here, and they've done over the years, even with, you know, functional reprints in such weird ways, you know, they've done a fantastic job. But it's like with any card that's printed, it's like taking a rock and throwing it into a pond. You get ripple effects, and you'll continue to get them. It's the same thing here. Every time they print something new, Jace Friend's Prodigy, best example, put it out there, created a ripple in Modern at the time. So they have, you know, they're doing the best they can.
Yeah, I mean, my point of view is pretty much the same. I mean, Wizards has done a great job. They created this relic that doesn't make any sense to us now today. It doesn't really serve any purpose today. It was a promise they made the players back at the beginning of this game when they had to do something to keep collectors interested. And now it's had this effect, you know, 10, 20 years later. So, I mean, it's something that needs to be changed, but I understand at the same time that Wizards is in a very tight position. They're between a rock and a hard place here where they can't really just say, this is it, we're doing it, to hell with the reserve list, here we go. They have to tread carefully, and I respect that. So, I mean, yeah, hats off to them. They're doing a lot of things here to try to make it better for the players, and they've definitely done that in the last few years. So I think we're out of the era of the collector in MTG. We have plenty of people buying and selling. We have plenty of people playing, but collecting, not so much anymore. So let's try to get rid of this thing in the past and move forward. All right, so that's going to do it for us this week. Alex, any videos going up anytime soon?
I've been slacking. I've been focusing more. GP Detroit's coming up, man. Yeah, I've been trying to get my Modern game on. I got to practice a new deck since Twin's gone. So I've been focusing on that. I did put up an Ad Nauseam video set. I might put up another one, week before GP Detroit and stuff like that. But I'm going to keep trying to push forward on stuff like that. So look forward to them in the future.
Nice. Very cool. But all right, that's going to do it for this week. So we're going to get on out of here, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye.
Oh, snap.